are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, I'm Dr. Jane from the Blues Junction. Tune in to KBOO for the Waterfront Blues 2020 Highlight Special this Saturday, September 26, from 5 to 7 p.m. Join me on the Blues Junction as I take you through some of the best live tracks from the virtual Waterfront Blues Festival this year. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues 2020 Highlight Special this Saturday, September 26, from 5 to 7 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host Jamie Partridge. Tonight we're talking about labor, black lives, and labor against fascism. Our guests are Laura Weldlin and Zayad, did I say that right?
That's Jad Ziadi.
Laura is a part-time instructor at Portland Community College, a member of the PCC Faculty Federation, and the Democratic Socialists of America Labor Working Group. Jad is active with the Unemployed Workers Council and also a member of the DSA. Welcome, Laura and Jad.
Thanks, comrades.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. As we record this interview, Portland has broken all protest records with over 100 continuous days of street demonstrations against police brutality and for racial justice since the murder of George Floyd by the police in Minneapolis. Portland, one of the whitest cities in the nation, has seen huge marches with thousands of people led by young black people, but with mostly white participants. We are in the midst of a deep economic crisis and a severe pandemic forcing much of the population indoors, yet we see a sustained uprising of street action.
What's going on? Y'all want to give your impressions?
Well, the most obvious takeaway in my eyes is that a lot of white people really do care about fighting racism and police brutality and are even willing to put themselves in physical danger for the cause, which is great news for anyone hoping to build a movement rooted in multiracial solidarity.
Jad, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I guess a couple things, you know, spring to mind about, you know, as far as what's happening and why it's happening the way it is, you know. So I think, you know, I agree with what Laura just said. I think it's absolutely wonderful and amazing and very inspiring. And it's good to remember that, you know, these kinds of uprisings build on what happened before them. And that, you know, there's like a string that you can tie from what is happening now back to the Bernie Sanders campaigns, then to the first Black Lives Matter uprising, to Occupy Wall Street, to the uprising in Madison, Wisconsin, to the Arab Spring, and so on. And I think the current Black Lives Matter protests builds on the past in two important ways that we need to keep in mind. First being that I think it was the first Black Lives Matter uprising that put racial justice on the center stage of the national discourse in a way it hasn't been in a very long time. And I think back to when I first joined a socialist organization back in 2011, and the first protest that I took part in as a member of that organization was a protest against the impending execution of Troy Davis. And that protest was tiny, isolated, and no one knew who the hell we were or what we were doing. We were just maybe, you know, 10 or 11 or 12 people on a street corner in Portland, Oregon. And clearly, the situation is very different today. And that is because, very largely, due to the past racial justice struggles that have existed. And I think there's a second part that's equally important, in that this movement also builds on past struggles that have also been vital, but have not yet been properly linked specifically to racial justice, at least not very broadly, yet I think have very importantly helped expose and delegitimize capitalist ideological hegemony. Like Laura was saying, you know, in other words, there's lots of people who are protesting, and I think there are, they're there because they genuinely want to see racial justice become a reality, but also because they see the system as a whole as unjust, you know, including police murder, including economic injustice, including a healthcare system that fails workers, including evictions. And they understand that Black and brown and poor workers are most severely affected by this unjust system, but it's a struggle that affects them too. And that a lot of white people who have shown up to these protests see this struggle, at least in part, as part of their own. And I think that's really wonderful, really amazing, and you know, incredibly inspiring, you know?
So Jad, I know you've been out in the streets quite a bit. What's that been like for you? What did you think of the actions and the demands and the leadership that you experienced out in those 100 days of continuous street demonstrations?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first and foremost, again, like I said, it's exciting, inspiring. You know, what we're seeing is just absolutely undeniably wonderful. I think it proves the strength of so-called ordinary people united in action, many of whom are protesting for the first time in their lives and are seeing, I think, more clearly for themselves the nature of the state and what purpose the police serve, and what people can accomplish, you know, or at least begin to accomplish when they work together. You know, again, like these sorts of slogans, abolish the police or defund the police, were demands that were by and large previously relegated to small, isolated, radical circles. So that said, though, I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant, forgive me. I think it's important to acknowledge both the inroads we've made towards these goals, but just as importantly, to acknowledge that we're still very far from accomplishing, you know, full police abolition, and what that would take and look like, and what tools we have to rebuild on the left today to begin to genuinely move toward that. You know, so we can never forget, for example, that when we rise up, anytime we rise up, the capitalist state can be very effective and very adept at granting us small reforms when its managers see the need to temporarily go on the defensive. But, you know, in such cases, as we've already seen, right, there are a couple of very important things I think we need to remember. First, the capacity of the capitalist class to tolerate reform is tied to profit, and they will attempt to roll back any reforms we force them we force them to give us as soon as they can. And second, our capacity to not just prevent that rollback, but also build on our minor victories, to try to answer the second part of your question, as we target larger victories, depends on our organizational capacity. In other words, how do we sustain ourselves? How do we choose the tactics and strategies that carry us forward? And that depends, I think, very heavily on open debate and democratic organization and elected accountable leadership. And I think that's important. I told you I was going to rant. I'm almost done. Don't worry. you know, I think that's not just important in the case of leadership, say, because all leaders are human, and therefore they will fail in some manner, probably repeatedly, and they need to be held accountable, and not just a manner that is just and reasonable, but one that is transparent and easy to follow and does not foster distrust in the movement. But I think also these structures are crucially important because they're the only genuine method by which anyone who participates in the movement can help direct it. any can question any choices that are made, raise any disagreement, and suggest different avenues to explore, which oftentimes I think us dedicated organizers will often forget, and will be always pleasantly and excitedly surprised when we hear new voices suggest different tactics that we had not yet considered. And finally, I think, you know, the importance of these democratic organizations are so crucial, because I think this structure, this democratic open structure, is the best armor against what I think is currently maybe the biggest danger, which is co-optation by the liberal establishment. In that, I think liberals are very, very excellent at, they know how to tokenize a member of an oppressed group and use that person to divert a movement against oppression away from realizing genuine gains. You know, so for example, I often hear center black voices, to which I always am compelled to ask, which black voices? Because literally every day I hear black voices with whom I strongly agree and black voices with whom I strongly disagree. And I can't help but notice that the black voices that support the establishment liberalism, that whitewash people like Ted Wheeler, that advocate for strategies that I think will ultimately hobble us, are much louder and better positioned than the black voices coming from our fellow workers. Because there is a class distinction at play here that as of yet has not had the structure within which we can reveal it. And I think even that is a simplification, in that there will be black revolutionaries who will be wrong, simply put, like anyone else. To state otherwise, I think, is to turn an entire population of humanity into a caricature. You know, we really have to resist this myth that keeps emerging that, you know, all black people think the same things, say the same things, or want the same things.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think we really struggle with, especially when we have those center leadership roles filled by handpicked people, by, you know, that Ted Wheeler has gone out and specifically asked to step up and speak. And speaking of city council, the Portland City Council recently cut the police budget by a measly $15 million in response to hundreds of residents testifying for defunding the police, eliminating police in Portland Public Schools and on TriMet, eliminating the Gun Violence Task Force, and expanding funding for Portland Street Response, the social service alternative to policing the homeless. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty, who has been pushing for these reforms for decades, credited the street action for moving the council to do the right thing. The demand of the protest leaders is for $50 million in cuts to the police and investments in black communities. So the street protests continue after a brief pause or smoke, although it's in much smaller numbers. Where is the street action going? Is it going to continue, or?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that we're going to see a surge of street action after the election, no matter what happens, and I certainly hope we do, because it's very likely that no matter what happens, Trump is going to say he won, and we need to make it very clear that that's a political narrative we're not going to accept. And so I'm really glad you brought up the example of Commissioner Hardesty pushing the reforms and crediting the street action, because if our street actions go independently, divorced from a larger political strategy, I don't think it's going to go towards the reforms that we so desperately need. And I think that going forward, we need to make sure that it's not just a project in and of itself, it's a tactic to force action from decision makers. That's always how political campaigns have to work. And if the tactics you're choosing don't work towards that, then what's the point? We're spending a lot of energy on something that isn't getting us closer to what we really want. But I do think that street action is an incredibly important part of any campaign. And so is, of course, the labor movement.
You're just tuning in. This is Labor Radio, KBOO Portland. Our guests tonight are Laura Wadlin of PCC Faculty Federation, American Federation of Teachers, and the Democratic Socialists of America Labor Group, and Jad Ziadi of the Unemployed Workers Council. Which brings us to the question of the labor movement. While there are thousands of working class people that have flooded the streets and small gatherings have popped up in various neighborhoods all over town, labor unions, supposedly the voice of the working class, have not participated except to make broad statements against racism or past resolutions condemning misbehaving cops. Why is this happening?
Is that for me or Jed?
Either one.
Laura, why don't you take that one?
Well, I think most people who are in a union these days can see that the perspective of the labor movement and a lot of the leaders in the labor movement is not the same perspective as it was maybe in the beginning of the 20th century, where unions were very militant and definitely pushed for more like common good type demands. The New Deal was largely a product of labor militancy. And these days, speaking as a union member, I don't see that perspective as much. And I wish that it were a bigger part of how we see not just what is the purpose of a union, but how does a union get power? And sometimes there's a stereotype, when you say working class, people hear that as white working class. They hear the white inherently in the term working class, which is silly. But I think a good way to combat that would be for labor unions to show that they are serious about fighting racism and will put their strike power where their mouth is, essentially.
So again, Laura, your executive board of your state union, the American Federation of Teachers for the state of Oregon, passed a truly radical resolution calling for cops out of universities and schools, for cop unions to get out of the labor movement, and for the defunding, disarming, and disbanding of police departments. And members of your union brought that same resolution to the Northwest Oregon Labor Council. And members of your union turned out for the Labor Day March for Black Lives. What's with your union? Why are they so active in this particular fight?
Well, I am very proud to be in a union that has committed to opposing police violence. And I think most importantly, we have leadership at the state level in American Federation of Teachers Oregon that is willing to take this political risk. As I understand it, they took a lot of heat for this resolution. And it goes to show how much even a small number of leaders, even one leader, can really set the culture for the whole organization. And for union members listening now who are unsatisfied with their union's political inclinations, I urge you to step up into leadership positions, even like unelected ones, like being on a committee, for example, because it can really make a difference. You can find other people who think like you do and want the union to be more progressive or more willing to go on strike.
That's awesome.
So, Laura, when your union brought this resolution to the on the police to the Northwest Oregon Labor Council, the AFL-CIO, this AFL-CIO Federation representing more than 100,000 union members in the Portland area, was brushed aside. It was hardly even discussed. And this was after 2 months of sustained street protests against police by working class people with sustained brutality by police against protesters. And this after two centuries of sustained police violence against labor unions when we go on strike, brushed aside. Some union representatives objected that police unions needed protection because they are workers too, and an attack on any union is an attack on all unions, especially public sector unions. One union rep complained that his union represented cops in many jurisdictions and their safety against rioters had to be defended. What do you both think about all that?
I first want to say that I think that when we talk to other union members who take this perspective, that we should speak to them as fellow workers and not dismiss their concerns out of hand. And people who say those things, I feel like they have the right inclination, which is to stand in solidarity with other workers. But unfortunately, when it comes to police, it's not mutual. So when we see workers on strike, we want to support them. We want to donate to their strike fund. We refuse to cross the picket line. We might even consider a sympathy strike. But law enforcement's job is to do exactly the opposite of that. When workers protest and picket, cops are the ones who arrest them. When workers are worried about losing wages and getting evicted, cops are the ones who would escort them out of their homes. So much of what they do is hostile to the working class just simply because of how the system is set up. Like, I want to live in a world where we can count on unarmed public safety officers and emergency responders to protect us, and I would want them to have the same protections of any other worker. But that's not how police function. And if you're worried about attacks on unions, then you should want to disempower the police. Because, like, irrespective of any individual police officer's feelings, the police force is not on our side.
Jed, did you have anything to add to that?
No, not really. I'm essentially in full agreement. I really liked what Laura said, especially what you said concerning how we should be approaching our fellow workers with respect and engaging with them in conversation and hearing them out, especially because I think we are going to often be in circumstances in which we are going to get into these arguments. And of course, we should be completely upfront and honest about our politics, and we're still going to lose the argument in the sense that we might not convince a fellow worker of our perspective. But I think that's perfectly fine as long as we bring it up to them in a manner that's respectful and open and honest, so that in cases when we can't win the argument, we're at least planting the seed.
Thank you. Laura, you're with the DSA working or labor working group, and that group has a banner with the old union slogan. God, I can't even speak this evening. An injury to one is an injury to all. As socialists trying to disrupt capitalism by uniting the multiracial working class, you have organized to actively support the uprising against police brutality and systemic racism. Tell us about that work, DSA.
Yeah, so the Portland DSA Labor Working Group participated in several of the street marches in support of Black Lives Matter in downtown Portland. We marched alongside other unions, and in particular, there were a lot of teachers, healthcare workers, and tradespeople. That was great to see. We got a really positive response from other protesters at the march when they saw our flags and banners. People said, "Oh, hey, I'm in DSA too." Or, "Oh, thanks DSA for coming out and supporting." I had a sign that said "Fight racism with union power," and a young person came up to me and asked, "Oh, you're in a union. What is that exactly?" So we had a good conversation about that. And I just see that over the last like half century, the labor movement has been very weak, unfortunately. But we're seeing a real surge of support for unions from people my age and younger. And we need to make it clear to them that if they're interested in fighting for racial justice, workplace campaigns are a great place to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jad, the Unemployed Workers Council, of which you are a member, was the brainchild of Portland's Democratic Socialists of America chapter and emerged at about the same time as the uprising for Black Lives. What's the connection, and how has the Unemployed Workers Council intervened in the uprising?
So I think the connection is in two parts. I think first it is simply a matter of one, the deepening economic crisis, the pandemic, and also the level of inspiration, I think, that has been created by the Black Lives Matter uprising. That is, I think, the most direct connection. But of course, there's the deeper political connection, which I think ties to the struggle for Black liberation as well as to labor militancy, and I think to every other corner of the working class, in that when you look at our demands, expand unemployment insurance to all who need it, including sex workers, undocumented workers, all others who fall through the cracks, and make it easily accessible. So that means no means testing, hire more UI workers, simplify the application process. And we are also have a list of demands that goes beyond unemployment insurance, right? Because we're talking about protecting unemployed workers, period. So we want a safe jobs guarantee. We want rent cancellation. We want housing for the houseless. We want an end to evictions. And we want Medicare for all. And I think these demands are deeply tied to the struggle for Black liberation, in that in capitalist society, the most marginalized groups of the working class suffer to the sharpest degree. And I think the connection to organized labor is vital, in that I think, frankly, we have no chance of winning these demands without a mass, militant, organized working class. So as of now, what we're doing in the uprising, we're holding rallies. We're organizing contingents to join in on solidarity marches. And we're planning a few other events and strategies that I don't want to speak to yet. We're still a fairly young organization, and we haven't hashed anything out. We haven't hashed out a lot of stuff that we're still working towards. So for now, keep your eyes open.
Great. Thank you. At the time of this interview, we are a few days away from the return of the Proud Boys, a white supremacist, Trump-loving Blue Lives Matter crew who like to descend on liberal Portland, provoking street fights and terrorizing neighborhoods. Both of you will be part of the Labor for Black Lives, Labor Against Fascism contingent of the community counter-protest this weekend. Tell us first about the connection between defending Black lives and opposing fascism, and why it's important for labor unions to be involved. We'll go ahead and start with Laura.
Yeah, labor unions are a serious threat to white nationalism, and I say that proudly. And that's because we promote class solidarity across lines of race, gender, religion, nationality, and other factors. We demonstrate that the problem in society is not other workers, but in fact, the ruling class. The owners, the investors, the bosses, they are the ones that keep us toiling for low wages, that make it so hard to have a comfortable home and good health. And most importantly, they are the ones that benefit from working class people being divided. So labor unions should be the first line of defense against fascists, because we are organized where we are most powerful against the ruling class, which is the workplace.
Thank you. Jad, did you have anything to add?
I think Laura's absolutely right. You know, we want to win some pretty ambitious victories here. And I think the only road to which we do that, through which we do that, is through the power of organized labor to halt profit at the point of labor, in that that is really the only thing that capitalists care about, profit. And so when we are organized and strong enough to hit them where it really hurts is when we begin to really see results and we begin to really understand our power and to amplify it.
So to just riff a little bit more on this point, how do you both see this struggle against racism and fascism playing out in the coming period, and what labor unions can and should do?
The labor movement needs to show our power and be willing to go to war with capitalists. Otherwise, I think we're going to lose a lot of people to the appeal of fascism. We need to prepare now for how we will go on strike to protect ourselves and our communities, because the neoliberal hegemony will not offer a serious alternative to the rightward push, and uncoordinated street actions will only get us so far. When we look at historical examples, like I mentioned earlier, of when the labor movement changed society, like in the early 20th century, we can see that it's up to militant unionists to pave the way forward.
Dots, Chad?
Yeah, again, Laura hit it right on the head, I think. And I think, of course, now today we have to find whichever avenues we can, as small as they may be, and as unillustrious as they may seem, to affect as much change as we can in the here and now. Because I think what we do today either widens or narrows the avenues of tomorrow. And I think that's always the case.
How can our listeners connect with your organizations and find out more information?
You can visit the Portland DSA Labor Working Group website at tinyurl.com/pdxdsalabor, or you can email us at portlanddsalabor@